KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
It's Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment, with another web-exclusive episode. This week, Elvis chats with writer-director Jeff Nichols about his third film, Mud. Matthew McConaughey plays the title character, a fugitive hiding from a group of bounty hunters hot on his trail. Mud's hiding place is soon discovered by two high school friends named Ellis and Neckbone. And together, they hatch a plan to help Mud run away with his true love, Juniper, played by Reese Witherspoon. Jeff Nichols joined Elvis in front of a live audience following a screening of Mud. Thanks, as always, to the Film Independent at LACMA screening series, which Elvis curates, for letting us record the interview.
One of the things we were just talking about backstage, I think this has come up a couple of times whenever I've seen you, is you write about people who are basically almost possessed, who have a single goal that they want to fulfill. Where do these guys come from?
Well, the way I'd answer that is...
Yes, how would you answer that, Jeff?
I believe people build personal philosophies for themselves, belief systems. Like in Shotgun Stories, I think there's a nobility to Mike Shannon's character. He hears that his father's dead, there's going to be a funeral, and he knows people are going to be saying nice things about him. And he just can't let that slide. Like he can't, and it's a principle that he has in his life. It's not necessarily right. It doesn't lead to positive things, obviously. But he has this belief system that he's built. And certainly the same for Mike's character in Take Shelter, and then the same for Mud. He has this weird supernatural philosophy that he applies to life, and it dictates everything he does, you know, where he goes and when he kind of, you know, dodges and ducks, and I don't know. I don't know where that comes from, but I think it's true. I'm kind of always revamping and re-engineering my own belief system and thoughts on the world. So.
But I mean, I find myself wondering in some way if this is a comment on basically what it requires to be an artist, you know, that kind of obsession and persistence of vision, because these characters all have that. Again, I said possessed because this is one thing that gets under their skin and they're determined to make it happen.
It's really funny that you asked that, because my personal approach is totally the opposite, like in my own life. Okay. When I first got out of college, I was really lucky. I got a job working on a documentary about Townes Van Zandt, who, I don't know if you guys know who he is. You should find his music if you don't. And he was the kind of guy that I think lived his life in order to write songs about pain. You had to live in pain. And there's a brief interview in that doc by Steve Earle, and he was just like, that's not true. Like, you don't have to do that. You don't have to be a heroin addict. And I kind of side with Steve Earle. I live a very boring life, you know, and I don't know, I fantasize about fun, exciting, twisted things.
Yes. Yes, you do. because I just find myself thinking that there's that, these coarse... And these courses that these guys' lives are all on, and they basically kind of ruin the lives of everybody around them by following these courses. Because I can't say any of these guys are stupid. But I can't say any of these guys are dumb, but they're predetermined. So it's like fate is ordained that they're going to follow these courses. It's almost, for me, beyond psychology in some ways, you know?
Well, you know, also, it's worth pointing out that I really don't write from a place a plot. I write from character, and my plots are kind of dictated by my characters. So perhaps the trajectory that you're feeling in these people is because I let that be the trajectory of the plot, which some people don't like, and you know, maybe it's why my movies are not as accessible for some people. But it's because I don't like thinking of these people as just chess pieces that are there to play out this game that I want them to play. You know, I really care about these people. And in fact, when Shotgun Stories came out, there was a review out of a New York publication that I think referenced them as fools, which would be very easy to do, because I mean, the guy's sleeping in a tent and living in a van. But I remember being offended by it personally, Because I was like, they're not fools. They're not fools. They're unique people, but they've just got a way. They've got to look at life that's different than other people. But I never look down on my characters. You know, I think too, when you write stuff in the South, it's if you're looking down at the people you're writing about, that's the fastest road to affectation. You know, that you can take. All of a sudden, there are these bumbling idiots. That aren't they funny, you know? And that's not where I'm coming from.
Well, because these guys are, though, as we're talking about Southerners, and they're basically almost like charismatics in their way, you know? I mean, they weave this kind of spell, and people fall under these spells, even as you can see them trying to fight them a little bit, like Jessica a little bit, and then take shelter. She kind of knows better, but she's going along. She's caught in the undertow anyway.
Yeah. It's my approach was different. Though that between that and Mud, Mud really is supposed to be a charismatic man. You know, there was a guy. My dad owns a furniture store in Little Rock, and there was a guy that worked for him that he eventually fired because I think he was stealing stuff. But he'd been with the store forever, and I was talking to my brother about him one time. I was like, "Yeah, but he's such a nice guy," and he's like, "It's because he's a liar. He makes you feel good about yourself," and
What?
Yeah, and it's actually a line that Reese's character says about Mud, because it's like he's able to give you compliments and he lies to you and it's what you want to hear, but it doesn't feel like you're being manipulated at the time, but that's what he's doing. And the thing about Mud is he does that, but he doesn't do it in a malicious way. I never saw him as a malicious character, which is maybe a bit of a surprise, because I definitely build it in such a way where you question his, you know, motivations. But yeah, Take Shelter was different because that was just about marriage. You know, that was about commitment. And so she's not hanging in because Mike's character's so, you know, charming. And I know that that's a simplification of it, but she's hanging in because she loves this man, and this is commitment. It's actually the polar opposite of Mud and Juniper in a weird way.
It is, but I mean, like charismatic in the old school way, almost somebody who's been like possessed by a force. I mean, not just the exercise of charisma, but somebody who's been possessed, right. and people are pulled along in that slipstream. But right. To get back to Mud a little bit, I said to you backstage that he's kind of a Byronic character, and when he talks about things, that sense of conflation is just, I'm not sure if he's lying as much as that's what he honestly thinks at the time he's saying it.
Sure. And I was kind of that way. A friend of mine, we were talking about snake bites, and they're like, you know, you can't get treated twice for that because it's made out of horse blood. And to this day, I don't know if that's true. It doesn't really sound true. but I didn't want to Google it because it sounded like something Mud would believe. And he does. Like, he really thinks that.
I have to say, well, the first time I saw it, I laughed out loud when Sam Shepard goes, oh, no, I wasn't working for the CIA. I was a sharpshooter. But, of course, that's what Mud would think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why for me, it seems like he's not a liar. That's just the tale he comes up with in his head. Whenever he hears something, he builds a whole story around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the belief system.
And again, it's not malicious, you know? And that's why I think we can hopefully end up liking him. It was funny, though. There's a scene where Sam Shepard's character yells at him for the first time out on the island, and then Sam Shepard walks away, and then Ellis walks back up, and Mud immediately gives him this note. And in the script, I didn't think that was very manipulative, but when I saw it on set, I was like, God, how can he just be, this guy's yelling at him, and then he brings this 14-year-old boy, and it's like, it's kind of dangerous, be careful. And which I really liked. I was glad that I was feeling that, but it was it was unexpected, actually, just how manipulative that felt.
I guess because it went from being like an abstraction to what this behavior really sort of suggested, you know, that, and by the way, I love when they go see Juniper, and she talks about them, she goes, oh yeah, we read it.
Yeah.
Because they want to know what he's thinking. It's the thing you're saying backstage. But, I mean, to them, they're like Bonnie and Clyde and Romeo and Juliet. They're really mythic figures in sure. their lives.
Yeah, like we were saying, it's why I needed movie stars, you know. Because to Ellis, maybe not so much neck bone, But
one of the greatest names in the history of movies, by the way, Neckbone.
I have an anecdote if you would like it.
I would love to hear the Neckbone anecdote.
A friend of mine walked into a bar and saw these guys, and he told it as just like breakfast time, but I don't, whatever. And at the back of the bar, these guys were playing dominoes, and this guy slapped down a domino and yelled, "It's on like a pot of neck bones." And I'd written that line down on a note card in my office, and it was just sitting there, and I just was looking at the word neck bone, and it stuck. But
that was worth hearing. So anyway.
That was a tangent. What were we talking about?
Talking about when basically they go into a room, they say, "We read the note," because they're like Bonnie and Clyde or Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah, the movie stars. Yeah, yeah. Because to these boys, you know, these characters are larger than life. You know, Mudd is a kind of iconic figure to Ellis. And that's how mentors are, you know. I've had mentors in my life that are separate than your dad or your mom, you know, because those are your parents, so you have a different relationship with them. But the first time that a non-familial, you know, mentor comes into your life and they give you a piece of information that you just really need, and you think that they must have a line on the universe. You know, you want to listen to everything they have to say. And the problem is, if they stick around long enough, you realize they're full of shit, and then you realize they're real people and they're fallible, and then that can diminish the first thing they told you, which you really needed, you know? And then they move through your life and you're kind of done with them, but it doesn't actually diminish what they were there for, you know? I don't know, I was thinking a lot about that when I was writing this film, but yeah, like these boys, and I told this to Reese when I was first talking to her about the part, I was like, your character has to live in scenes that you're not in. And the same goes for Mudd, you know? Your character's presence has to bleed outside of the frames that you possess. And that's what's great, actually, about having movie stars. You know, I mean, they're movie stars, and I say that in a positive way, not a negative way. Because a lot of times you go make a film and you have to work against that, because you got to make them real people, because we're making movies about real people and real aesthetic and everything else. But in this case, I could take advantage of it. You know, but they're also, I think they're both such good actors. They can do both. It's just I don't know. I needed that charisma.
But you were saying that you wrote this for Matthew McConaughey. That
I did.
You conceived this with him in mind.
I did. I started thinking about this in college back in the late 90s. And, you know, sometimes ideas just kind of hit you on the head. And I had the idea of a man hiding out on an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. I said it just about that clearly. And I was just thinking about people who would be hiding out there. And I thought about Matthew McConaughey. I'd seen Dazed and Confused, which was great, but I'd also seen Lone Star. And what he does in Lone Star, which is thanks to John Sayles, is he actually is the flesh and blood personification of a legend, of a myth. You know, this whole movie's built around his legend. And then you see him and you're like, yeah, I buy it. And then thanks to Sayles' writing and direction, then he becomes fallible and different and changes, and it becomes kind of a compound statement. And I've been doing press for the last 2 weeks, so that sounds like I was really smart at the time. I didn't really have it that well figured out. But it made sense to me that he could fit into it, like a mythic character.
But between him and Sam Shepard, you've got two mythic male figures, two eras of masculinity in this movie. And was that something you knew all along you had to have in this too, two iconic actors?
Well, male mentors again, and so you know, I don't know about it because I had Joe Don Baker too, but
Joe Don Baker was going to do it.
No, Joe Don Baker's in it.
No, yeah. No, I mean, because the Sam Shepard.
Oh
part.
No. Yeah, it was all not just fathers and sons. It was actually male mentors. Okay. You know, and I was really thinking about, you've got these kind of macho guys. But the movie's about romantic love, you know. It's not about sex; it's about love, and we don't often visit that topic through a male point of view. And so I thought it would be really interesting to have this kid trying to figure it out, and he's looking up at all these adults around him, males, and they just have terrible, just terrible people. They're just terrible examples. I mean, Mike Shannon is one of the worst examples of love, you know, in this movie. And But everybody needed their counterpoint, and Sam Shepard was Mudd's counterpoint. He was that was Mudd's mentor, you know, who had his own hang-ups about love, with the whole lone wolf thing.
It's interesting too, because you're talking about these men, but these women. I told you, for me, the most heartbreaking moment in the movie, and really the beginning of the emotional climax, is when he sees what he thinks is his girlfriend, and he waves at her across the parking lot, and she just doesn't acknowledge him. And then we see that mirrored when he walks into the bar. Yeah. I mean, that's, and he sees Juniper with just some guy. I mean, that's truly, I mean, that's, there's so much emotion packed in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that bar scene was the one, you know, that bar scene was the one on the page that I was like, this is it. This is where I have to break a 14-year-old boy's heart, you know, on screen. And
you say that with some relish, Jeff.
I needed to get it right, or else the movie wouldn't work. So, but I remember that. You know, I had a moment like that parking lot moment, where he waves and a girl doesn't wave back. I had a moment like that in high school, and I had a moment where a girl broke my heart, and I was physically nauseous. Like it's a very palpable feeling, and I remember, you know, going on press tours for Take Shelter and talking about how anxiety was palpable. Well, this is another emotion. It's a different emotion, but it was palpable. And in Shotgun Stories, I was thinking about if one of my brothers was killed, that was palpable. So I feel like each of these movies is anchored by something that, by a very specific emotion that creates like a physical response in me. And it's something that at any point in the process, through the writing or the directing or the editing, I can think about it and it comes back up, you know? I think if you do that, if you have that to lean on, you can do whatever the hell you want. You can have a shotgun shootout and stuff, but you need it's an emotional kind of punch in the gut.
Is that why these movies are so fable-like? Because there is that big emotional moment that reminds me to some extent of, as we're talking about backstage, and as you said in any number of interviews, Mark Twain, but also, that's why I said Byron, and maybe even a little bit of some of the Grimm's fairy tales, where there's like a big emotional moment that's kind of about the end of innocence.
Man.
I'm sorry, was that?
No, it's a great question. It's such a better question than I'm suited to answer.
Okay, what was Reese Witherspoon like?
Yeah, right? Why did he take his shirt off? No, it's such an intelligent question. I'm sorry.
We'll come back to it. No, what was Reese Witherspoon like?
I think I'll come back to that. I think all those stories are classic stories because they connect to us, you know. Flannery O'Connor, and I'm paraphrasing, said, you know, writing at its best goes well beyond the writer's intention, you know. It starts to live in another place. And you don't always get to do that, you know. I guess that's the zeitgeist, and very rarely do people get to make films or tell stories that touch it. And I'm constantly trying to figure out how to do it. I think the only way you can speak or even attempt to speak on a universal level is to make something extremely personal. There's so many movies I go see and I walk out of and I just didn't feel anything. I never felt anything. And I knew with Shotgun Stories, I remember thinking, like, I get it. The first 45 minutes is real slow. And maybe then the next 30 is really slow too. But like, if you give me 45 minutes, I promise you'll feel something. You know, you'll feel sad. Sorry, it's a spoiler, but you know.
I think I just saw this one, so it's okay if you spoil
this. Well, but you know, I think I don't know. I wouldn't claim to have any connections, but when I read those stories that you mentioned,
right.
I have that connection to them. You know, all those writers. So I can only think the reason why they're still around, the reason why we talk about them, is because they affect us. You know.
Well, I guess something else too I'd like to talk about a little bit is just these titles are such great titles between Take Shelter and Shotgun Stories and Mudd. I mean, they're really kind of potent, almost primal titles. Do the titles come to you first, or?
Shotgun Stories, this is ironic. I never even said this. Shotgun Stories came because I was reading a book by Sam Shepard called Motel Chronicles. And I was like, God, that's such a good title, Motel Chronicles. And I was thinking, like, can I rip it off? Like, can I use Motel or can I use Chronicles? But then I was saying the cadence over and over again, Motel Chronicles, shotgun stories, stories, chronicles. So that was me ripping off Sam Shepard. I don't think I ever even told him that. But
he's not here tonight, so you're good.
Yeah, this isn't, no one's recording this.
Nah.
So that was Shotgun Stories. To be honest, Take Shelter, the original title for Take Shelter was just Shelter. And there was another film coming out with that title, which I think just came out this year and was retitled. So we were all worried about it. We went into production with the title Shelter, and then we shot it with, it was called like the Untitled Jeff Nichols Project. It was on all the, you know, scripts and things. And I was killing myself and then trying to come up with, I came up with some terrible names. Because whenever you do it after, it's bad.
Really?
Yes. Whenever you try and reverse engineer a title, it's bad. Because yes, I do think of titles before I start writing. I have the titles before I start writing.
And what was some of the titles you came up with in lieu of Shelter?
Oh, God.
What, Shell Stories? Are you thinking about that?
It's like, if Faulkner hadn't used it, I would have really liked to use The Sound of the Fury. See, it's terrible. Terra Firma. There were so many bad ones.
Oh God, it was so bad.
I put it on a poster and looked at it. Just like a little thing, I JPEG. But the... So then I was like, let's just put the word take in front of it.
Okay. That was good. That was good.
Felt like a warning.
A little bit.
You know, it made sense. And then, but Mud was, you know, I was listening to a lot of Towns Van Zandt. There was Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold is a great song. Right. That has two Ds. So I went back and forth about whether or not to have two Ds or one D, and I decided to go with one D. But then, you know, and you start realizing, you start thinking it out. It's like, yeah, I'm going to have the character called that, which is a little cute. But 2 points. One, Mississippi Mud is a very real substance. We were caked in it the whole time. Like, it's like cement. It's like quickcrete or something. And it would get all over your shoes and all over your boots. So it exists. It's not fake. It's not like a, you know, a marketing scheme for Mississippi or something. And then number two, you're thinking about adolescence. It's a murky time. Yeah. I've been doing way too much press. Once you start doing press, you're just like, you don't even need analysis. It's just press.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Jeff, really.
Sorry.
I'm sorry to ask you these questions that everybody else hasn't asked you yet. I'll try to do
it. Damn you, didn't you get the memo?
Why did Matthew McConaughey take off his shirt?
Yeah.
There you go. How about
exactly.
that?
Exactly. Thank you.
I should have to tell you, I love that shirt and the fact that he's always got that pen in his pocket. That's such a great touch to me. It's such an authentic thing. Yeah, well, of course, he has nothing to write on, but he has a pen in his pocket.
He's got thoughts. He's got things. He's got to get down on paper.
But he's also, it feels like, too, that maybe somewhere he's off writing things down because, again, he talks so much.
Right.
And I love that he's constantly talking in the movie.
Yeah, that was my thing from the beginning. I'd written these films where no one speaks, and which I feel very comfortable writing that. And I did. I wanted to make a character that was verbose, that would talk And it's not just about talking. I wanted Mud to be in constant motion, this fluid motion, you know?
The camera's in fluid, constant motion, too, isn't it?
First time I ever used a Steadicam, yeah. And it was all by design. I wanted him to always be moving, you know? Shotgun Stories is stagnant. These men are stuck in their lives. Plus, we didn't have enough money to move the camera. But I reasoned it out.
Is that what you call reverse engineering?
That one was kind of reverse engineered. Take Shelter was, I had my shit together, and that movement was very specific. That I stole from The Shining. And it's just, you know, these slow push-ins, and it's all on dolly track. And dolly track is really specific because it locks your frame in. And that's an unmotivated camera movement, and so that says something. And what that says is that there's a force kind of beyond the edges of the frame that's pushing down and compressing our main character. It's what's happening to Nicholson's character in The Shining. It's the force of that place that he's in, and it's crushing him. And I was thinking about that for Take Shelter, and even shots that we filmed, you know, stagnant, I ended up adding like a 2 or 3% digital push-in drift on him. So that movement was very specific. I had that one thought out. Okay. And similarly, Mud, you know, it's about youth, it's about boys, it's about adolescence, it's about, you know, a transition in your life, it's about a river. And so, you know, I wanted it to flow. And there are actually a few shots in Jaws that aren't Steadicam, but that are they're just beautiful kind of hinged fluid masters in Jaws that you just don't even notice the camera movement. And it's because you're always with a character and you're moving with a character. And that's what we wanted to do here. I had a great Steadicam operator named Matthew Petrosky, who we went to school with. And I got out of school and became a director. He got out of school and like devoted his life to becoming a Steadicam operator. And he's great. And I said, though, you know, I'm scared of this. I've never used this before. You can do anything you want with it, and we shouldn't. So let's just pretend we've tied a rope around you and the actor, and you don't move unless they move. And if you watch it, he's always linked to them, and it's always linked to Ellis. And then that informs the lenses that you choose and everything else. But the whole thing was supposed to move like a river. Slow, fluid, and elegant movement. Not handheld, you know, camera.
There's so much beautiful sunlight in this movie, though, and so much great lens flare in this. We just talked about this back before we came on stage a little bit. I mean, it's a big leap from the other two films.
Well, I think, you know, on this one, I really had time. I had time to fully execute what was on the page, and this was a really dense story. I'd been carrying it around with me for so long.
You used a lot of time to come up with a visual plan, a scheme, as you were waiting to get a chance to shoot.
Yeah, and it was born out of all the movement that I'm talking about. But also, you know, we went to these places. That was the hardest thing about shooting on this island. We went to an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. The hardest thing was just picking what to shoot because it was all awesome looking. You know, you could shoot any angle you wanted, and it would be kind of strange and beautiful. And I mean, the island itself was a tremendous place. And we just put ourselves in the situation, you know, to take advantage of sun, always. You know, it was always there. And you shoot anamorphic, you know, and those lenses just, they pick it all up.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's tired. Let's thank Jeff Nichols for being here.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to a web-exclusive episode of The Treatment, recorded as part of the Film Independent at LACMA film series. For more information and upcoming screenings, visit filmindependent.org/LACMA.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.